It doesn't matter if you abscond with one $600 Social Security check or you pilfer, you know, investment accounts worth millions, the effects are devastating to the victim. I saw the future. We have an aging population. This is a growing problem. The case referrals that I'm getting are increasing.
You're listening to Karen Weber, a CPA, forensic accountant, and founder of fraudfinder.com. Welcome to the Fraud Fighter Podcast.
For the 60 plus population, one of the most prevalent forms of abuse is financial exploitation.
In this episode, we discuss how forensic accounting is used to fight elder abuse, the effects of financial fraud on elderly victims, why she started fraudfinder.com, and how the software service flags suspicious transactions. She's a CPA. She has a CFE credential. She's also the founder and CEO of fraudfinder.com. Karen Weber, welcome to the Fraud Fighter Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Robert.
Thank you, Karen. I do appreciate your time on the podcast. I've been interested in elder fraud, and I know you're an expert at it. But first of all, why did you pursue an accounting career?
I really liked the balance of debits and credits. You can check your work. If debits always equal credit, you know, as a perfectionist, that really spoke to me. You know, I can never be wrong, right? I like to live in that black and white area, but the transition to forensics started to get a little gray. But thankfully, I was one of the lucky ones in my college business program that accounting came naturally to. So I stuck with it.
When you were going through your accounting classes, was it easy to go from the principal side to the intermediate, really the nuts and bolts of it?
Yeah, you know, it was intermediate one was fine, but they said everybody, you know, you get weeded out, I guess, at intermediate two. I remember seeing a lot of my classmates just switch majors at that point, and I stuck with it. I did a lot of studying, right? It was hard work, but it was really just something that I enjoyed and wanted to stick with.
So why the accounting career? I mean, you like accounting as the skill set, but why the career itself? Or did you know at the time when you went into accounting?
For the longest time, I thought that I was going to be an architect. And I took this, I guess it was trigonometry or something in high school. And as you can imagine, again, being a bit of a perfectionist, I got an 87 in it, which was not an A. So if I did not get an A, clearly I didn't understand what I was doing in that. I was working at a grocery store in my hometown back in New York. I was doing like their daily money counting and doing their bank deposit in the morning. And the way that it works, everything had to balance at the end of the day, you know, your cash sales, your card sales. And when it didn't balance, you had to go figure out what the issue was. And I just loved that. It was like a logic problem. So that was my first intro to accounting. I had an uncle who was the managing partner of a big four. And he was always very successful. So the security of the career appealed to me as well. And ultimately, I went that route.
So nobody in your family other than your uncle was an accountant, per se, or had that type of career?
A couple of uncles are, but no one in my immediate family. You know, we came from a long line of engineers.
So how did you transition into forensic accounting? How did you go from accounting, graduating from a university with an accounting degree, and sliding into forensic accounting?
So when I was graduating college, it was at this interesting period in the accounting profession. And my year of graduation, at least in New York, was the last one in which you could sit for the CPA exam with 120 credit hours, basically a bachelor's degree.
Right.
Well, in subsequent years, they were changing the rules so that everyone would need 150 hours to qualify for that exam, basically a master's. So all of these colleges around my graduation time were starting these plus one MBA programs to hold on to enrollment. Mm-hmm. And I knew then at that point, MBAs would become a dime a dozen. And I wanted a way to differentiate myself. So the college I was at created this master's in forensic accounting program. And I ended up in their first graduating class. So going through recruiting, as you know, accounting firms come to the colleges and do interviews and that kind of thing, I asked around at all the firms that I interviewed with, you know, do you have a forensic department or at least, you know, a couple partners that practice in this area? And I wound up with a firm that had a very strong and established forensic department. And that's where I spent the first 5 years in this field.
So while you're working for that firm, what kind of credentials did you get? Or did you get any? I mean, I'm assuming you got the CPA license first.
Yeah, I got the CPA, but it took a very long time. I think I sat for the test like 11 times. It was
so much for the perfectionist.
Oh, yeah. You know, I was really lucky in school that I could read a textbook and I would do well, but the CPA exam is totally different. And that was, you know, and I didn't figure it out for many years. You just have to work problems over and over and over. And then, you know, once I figured that out, I finally did pass, but that was, was a rough number of years.
I understand. Did you, during the CPA exam, what was the biggest or the toughest part of it? Mine was auditing. I just didn't, I mean, it was one of those deals. I just didn't get it.
Audit was tough. I agree. Everything else far, that was debits and credits. Regulation, I took that twice. Audit, I want to say, maybe I took that like 3 or 4 times. It was ridiculous. But when I left school and went into the firm, I only worked in the audit department for about 3 months. And I was pretty vocal while I was there, like, I want to be in forensic. And ultimately, they pulled me in. So I never had that traditional, or that comprehensive traditional accounting.
You had no story that went with the question. I saw this one before. I had an audit. That's the reason why we did that. I mean, that type of thing. You had nothing related to other than just a textbook. That's it. I can understand that. Yeah.
Right.
Oh, okay. So you got the CPA license, and sooner or later you start becoming self-employed. How did you become self-employed?
Yeah, I have this independent streak, and I'm definitely one of those visionary types, right? Like, see a need and think of ways to fill it. So going back to college, I had an internship program in grad school. A local nonprofit aging, you know, focused on aging, came to the college and said, listen, I know you've got this forensic accounting program. We've got all of these social workers who are getting more and more referrals of financial exploitation cases. And we have no idea how to trace assets or, you know, reconcile bank accounts, things like that. Basic things an accountant would know, but mm-hmm. that isn't necessarily part of a standard curriculum for other professions. So I remember the email coming out from the career services office. I'm like, oh, that sounds really cool. It was a way to give back and, you know, do something meaningful with my skills and education at that point. So I started working on elder fraud cases, and it was a relationship. I kept the relationship with that nonprofit while I worked for the firm. I went and I said to my boss, listen, I do this thing on the side. They only pay, you know, X dollars an hour, certainly not public accounting firm rates. And he said, that's fine. You know, that's not an area of practice that we do. So it's not like you're competing. Just don't let it interfere with the work that you do here. Mm-hmm. So, you know, nights and weekends, I would work on those cases, which, you know, was part of the reason I didn't really get around to the CPA or struggled with it. Balancing all those three things was tough. But ultimately, you know, I saw the future, right? We have an aging population. This is a growing problem. The case referrals that I'm getting are increasing. And there's a national movement to address this problem, you know, that's become international at this point. I was married at the time, and my husband had started his own law practice 2 years before. So I kind of knew what it took to start a business, right? Like entity type, getting insurance and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So I just thought, you know, if I don't do this, I will probably watch someone else do this, and I don't want to miss this opportunity. So I made the leap.
So going from a W-2 earning forensic accountant working for a CPA firm, and then you dip your toes into the nonprofit, helping them out for their forensic accounting expertise, then you decided to go out on your own. Where did you get your clients?
It was word of mouth, really. I kept the relationship with the nonprofit, and some funding was coming down the pike from the state where they were expanding availability of forensic accounting to various counties. And so I think we started with 7 counties in New York, and that was my base to begin with. And then it expanded, of course, to, you know, where we are now. I did a lot of conference presentations, just went around the country speaking on this topic because really no one else was doing it. And that was a way to establish myself as an expert. And the referrals came in from there. And then different, you know, working these elder financial exploitation cases puts you in touch with, you know, law enforcement. district attorney's offices, when they got other sorts of white collar crime cases, they're like, oh, you know, we know Karen does this. We'll send her this case too. And so it just, I never had to do any real advertising. I think when you're good at what you do, the work speaks for itself.
The law enforcement typically are the first ones to get the phone call. You know, my aunt's been defrauded, or my dad sent some cryptocurrency, whatever else it is that they're dealing with. Are you getting paid by the state or by the law enforcement? How are you doing all this?
In New York, the way that it works is we get paid by the state for elder financial exploitation cases. Now we're also doing work in New Jersey in a number of counties as well. That is by agency. They just use the funding that they have available for this service because they think it is important. Same thing with different law enforcement agencies. It really depends. There are grants available to law enforcement departments for certain things, and sometimes they earmark it for this specific purpose.
Why does elder fraud matter? You got an expertise into it. Why does it make a difference? Because my vision is a guy in his 80s sitting at his, you know, watching TV, he gets the phone call, and whatever the fraud scam is for today, right? And he submits $1,000, $5,000, whatever else it is. I'm sympathetic to it. Don't get me wrong. I'm just trying to figure out, why does it matter from a big perspective, or does it?
Oh, it really does. I mean, first of all, our first responders are law enforcement, as we talked about. There's another agency out there called Adult Protective Services. And certainly most of us are familiar with the idea of Child Protective Services, mm-hmm. but that kind of agency also exists for the 18 and up population. And for the 60 plus population, one of the most prevalent forms of abuse is financial exploitation. And when we think about exploitation, normally we are, like you say, thinking about scams and fraud and all the stuff that we hear about on TV and in the news. What we're not hearing about is the fact that over 67% of the time, closer to 90, it is abuse, you know, stealing funds by family and friends, people we know that are exploiting older adults. And what happens to a victim, it doesn't matter if, you know, you abscond with one $600 Social Security check, or you pilfer, you know, investment accounts worth millions. The effects are devastating to the victim. Typically, victims lose their homes. They become more reliant on government assistance. They have worse mental health or outcomes than their peers, increased depression, rates of suicide, and actually even early death. So stealing someone's money is deadly to these individuals. And, you know, not only that, it tears apart families. And certainly we see that in you know, the trust and estate litigation cases that we work on.
I did not realize it's really an insider's job. The elder fraud is mostly, and it makes sense to me now that you say it. I just didn't realize it was mostly an insider's. I knew that the devastating amount could be insider's job, but I didn't think that the elder fraud was, I'm always thinking it's the phone call, you know, not the niece that's got the power of attorney on the aunt.
Yeah. I mean, when we go back to our, you know, foundational CFE education, right? You think about the fraud triangle, it's opportunity. Who is in a position of trust? And, you know, it's usually trusted others.
So what was the most interesting case that you worked on regarding elder fraud?
Steph and I love when we find those smoking guns, you know, we're pouring through all of these records, brokerage accounts, checking accounts, and all this stuff. And I don't know, I like when we uncover something. So one, I share all the time, relatively simple. There was a wealthy woman in the Finger Lakes region of New York, and she owned multiple homes on various different lakes. And anyway, she had hired this handyman to go and check on them when she became homebound. So mentally, she was with it, but physically, she just couldn't get out to her properties to check them out. So this guy goes out and, you know, he's mowing the lawn, and Adult Protective Services at the DA's office got a referral, like, something is going on with this guy. And I think it came from the bank. They were seeing just these excessive payments for handyman services, right? Like, she'd write in the memo line of her check, handyman services or lawn mowing, and it's like $1,000 payment. So the bank called it in to the authorities, and we got involved to do the investigation. When you think about exploitation, you think that you're paying attention to the spending that's going on in the account, right? Like, what's the outflow? Where is it going? But I like to pay attention equally to what's flowing into the account, right? Are accounts being consolidated? What's going on with the dividends that are being made? Are there other accounts out there that they might have access to? Well, $47,000 deposit that I didn't have any records for. I didn't know what it was in this one particular account. So we go back to the bank and say, can you get me a deposit of, or a copy of this deposit item? It comes back and it was a check from an insurance company, and the tiny memo line on it said for lost jewelry claim. So this woman had had like $47,000 worth of jewelry in a safe in one of her homes. The handyman took it, pawned it, got the cash from pawning it, but then he helped the older woman fill out an insurance claim form. The funds got deposited and he took those as well. And it was just like he got paid twice for taking this jewelry, and you know, we didn't even know, would never have known the jewelry was missing at all. So it's just the devil is in the details.
Interesting. Very interesting. So you started a company called Fraud Finder. What is it?
Fraud Finder is a SaaS, software as a service platform, and we built it specifically for law enforcement and adult protective services, those first responders that have to investigate these cases. We're lucky in New York and in New Jersey and other areas are just starting to allow funding for forensic accounting. But what about all of these other places where forensic accountants either don't exist from a geographical perspective, you know, super rural areas, tribal regions, that kind of thing, or, you know, where simply funding doesn't exist? And even in, you know, New York, for example, we are seeing this increasing volume of cases, but we don't have the people, you know, or the funds to handle all of them. The only solution is really technology. And so that's why I built Fraud Finder. And the premise of it is all of those financial records that we get in the normal course of an investigation can be uploaded to the software. It's read with OCR technology, instantly analyzed to look for all the things that we look for manually in our forensic accounting work, and produces a report in a court-recognized format. So that is the gist of Fraud Finder.
It's a software for particularly for elder abuse, or is it for just any type of forensic accounting needs?
Well, we built it specifically for elder abuse. So the future of this product is to iterate it for all the million other applications there could be. But this was my passion. This is where I saw a big need, and that's the need that we filled with it.
I have visions where you upload grandma's bank statements, right? And there is debit cards to a gas station. That's not uncommon, right? Or maybe a debit or expenses to Disney World. Grandma could have gone to Disney World. And then you have the going out to eat to restaurants. And then you have stuff like Victoria's Secrets and, you know, and other things that you're like, really? Is grandma going to Victoria's Secret? That doesn't sound right. It doesn't fit the bill. The common expectation of what expenditure should be for someone in their I'm gonna offend all the elderly people now on the podcast. I don't mean to though, but there's certain expenditures that just doesn't go with the age. Let me put it that way. How do you figure out, how's the software figure out this doesn't fit the bill of a 80-year-old man or a woman? This fits the bill of the 30-year-old niece who's still in the money.
Right. And you know, every case is unique, right? It could be that this is a normal expense for this individual. So what we did was, you know, based on the work that we have done with these agencies, you know, we pulled focus groups together and we built this really detailed intake wizard that guides their investigation. So when they're out in the field and they're interviewing the client, they're answering these questions that they answer within the platform that informs the static algorithms that exist. So for example, you know, you mentioned auto expenses earlier. You know, if you check that box, it says, you know, client does not drive, it's going to flag all the automated, you know, all the automotive expenses and have you look at those. So that's an example of how it works.
Oh, okay. So there's some type of questionnaire that helps identify the what the common expenditure should be for a person in that situation, whether it's age or mobility and that type of thing. That's interesting.
Yes. And that's at the transaction level. And then pattern wise, you know, if we notice that income drops in a certain month or spending increases in a certain month, or you know, you indicate that the client receives Social Security and then all of a sudden we don't see it deposited month to month, you know, those kinds of things, we've built algorithms in there and it will flag. So they're all basically investigative leads so that the investigator keeps kind of poking at the case and can get a full picture.
If someone was interested in forensic accounting, it sounded like you kind of like got an accounting degree and just kind of merged into the master's in forensics and then started your CPA firm type of thing. But if someone was interested in forensic accounting, whether they are a student or maybe they're in their mid-30s or early or late 20s, who wants to get into this form of accounting, what would you recommend to them?
Absolutely. I mean, if you're an existing professional, I highly recommend that you join the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners. And you can become a member whether or not you have the designation. You can purchase the materials to study for the exam there. They offer all sorts of continuing education in different areas, practice manuals, current events, that kind of thing. So the ACFE, if you're an existing professional, is really great. And then that certified fraud examiner designation, I have all my staff get it when I hire them, because it just sets you apart and it lets people know that I have a very specific fraud education. Now, if you are a student, I recommend kind of what I did is you go through the traditional accounting recruitment, right? Everybody needs to do that, as they say, 2 years at a public accounting firm, know the ins and outs of financial statements. But when you are interviewing, ask whether there's a fraud and forensic department or whether a partner practices in that area, someone that you can learn from and get the experience you need.
Any other credentials other than the CPA license and the CFE?
Oh, there are plenty. I mean, you could go a million different ways in forensic accounting. You can get credentials in business valuation. The AICPA has one called like Certified in Financial Forensics, I think a CFF. That's an option. There is certified internal auditor. I mean, forensic accounting isn't just fraud investigation, right? It's all those other non-traditional accounting services outside of audits, reviews, tax returns that we're all used to.
The non-sexy stuff.
You got it.
Reconcile this bank account. It's 20 pages long. There's a reconciliation report. Go for it. Okay. Gotcha. I remember those days. Are there any resources or training that helped you along your journey?
Well, certainly in my business reading in general, I'm always reading and starting your own practice, your own business, whether it's forensic accounting or not, it's tough and it's a lonely journey. So I read a lot. I still do read a lot of Entrepreneur and Inc. magazine, but specific to this topic, you know, say elder financial exploitation, I would recommend practitioners link up with their local adult protective services or nonprofit aging service providers, because they host plenty of educational opportunities throughout the year and ways for you to get involved in this issue. And then, of course, forensic accounting in general. Again, I'll go back to the ACFE. When you join and become a member, they put out Fraud Magazine every month or every other month, something like that. That always has, you know, current frauds that are going on and what people are doing to combat it.
Looking back on your career now, what was the biggest mistake or lost opportunity?
I can't say I have any real regrets, per se, but if I had to do it over, I think in both, you know, I own a CPA practice, and then later I started the tech company FraudFinder, I would start with co-founders. You know, I was very much, certainly in my younger years, a my way or the highway type of person. And you realize as you get older, or at least I did, that you can go farther faster when you do it in partnership with other people. So that's, you know, if I could have changed anything, that's what I would do. Start with co-founders.
What do you wish you had known when you started?
How long? I mean, that's a double-edged sword, right? Like, I wish I actually knew how long it takes to reach the point of security, you know, both in terms of cash flow, right? But also having the right people in the right place in your organization so that the wheels can keep turning even when you're not in the office. Probably if I did know that, you know, it was going to be 5 years on either side before that happened, it may have stopped me from starting. I'm certainly glad I didn't, but definitely it takes a while to get to the point of security, but you muddle through.
When you start your own practice and you're not really what I consider established, you just don't have a customer base yet or client base yet.
Yeah.
It does take, I would say, at least 2 years to get things rolling And it depends on your marketing and where you're at and who your clientele is, of course. And there's a lot of factors in there, but I could see where it takes 5 years to really, where the machine that you created is actually almost self-sufficient, getting close to it, you know? It needs maintenance every now and then, don't get me wrong, but it at least it's churning out the cash flow, and at least you don't worry about where the next meal's coming from, you know, tomorrow.
Yes. Oh, exactly. I mean, that was in the early days starting my CPA practice. I remember it was just me. And if I wasn't billing, we weren't making money. So if I want to take a week and go hiking in New Hampshire, you know, I'm not making money for that week. So, but, you know, in the fraud world, as you know, it's not like you frequently get these kind of recurring contracts like an audit or a tax return. It's like every year, January 1, you know, you're hitting the ground running, going, looking for your next case. So I had to get really creative. And what I, to be able to hire someone and make sure that cash flow was sufficient enough to bring someone on, I took a job as an adjunct professor. So I taught cost accounting, of all things, for a semester.
Cost accounting?
Yeah.
Boy, that was really reaching for it.
Oh my God.
I taught cost accounting for, I taught cost accounting 1 and cost accounting 2. Cost accounting 1 wasn't too bad. Cost accounting 2 was like, oh my soul, you really have to love this stuff to get into it.
Oh yeah. Well, it was cost accounting for non-majors, you know, so all these people that were going into like manufacturing in some role, like an engineer or whatever, they just had to understand, you know, variable costing and fixed costs and,
the variances, you know. Yeah, between volume and cost. Yes, I remember them.
College where I was teaching, there the paycheck would get deposited on a Friday, and I would, you know, in payroll for my intern would post the following Wednesday. So it was like I could keep her on, and I mean, you get creative like that. But yes, you know, to your point, it was a machine that ran on its own really between year 4 and 5. And that's when I started to move into creating Fraud Finder. I could step away from this current organization and focus on what's next. So that's how that happened.
Very good. If someone wanted to find out more about your firm or Fraud Finder, what would be the best place to find you?
Sure. WeberCPA.com, WeberCPA.com is the forensic accounting practice. And then Fraud Finder. .com for the software. That's FraudFinder.
No E in there.
No E in Fraud Finder.
Gotcha. I understand. All right. You ready for the final four questions?
Sure. Let's go.
Final four. What is your, I can kind of guess now, but what is your biggest motivation now?
Oh, I'm interested in what you guess. I'm really motivated by the teams that I've built. When you start your own thing, you create your own culture. And it was so important to me to choose people as I grew who were kind and had positive energy. Someone that you know, was smart, certainly, but you could sit down and get a beer with them because that's who you need to sit up, go to work and sit next to all day. So many of them have been with me for years now, and I'm just motivated to keep doing the best for them.
It's interesting when you are the leader of an organization, if the culture stinks, it's because of you. Yeah. It's not because of anybody. You can't blame it on anybody else. You're the one that hired these folks.
That's right. This is your baby. Absolutely.
What book or books have changed your life or thinking?
So most recently, I read Hangry by Mike Evans, and Mike founded Grubhub. So in it, and, you know, Grubhub, it went public and, you know, was hugely successful. But he talks about all the times that he just wanted to stop building it. And the theme of the book really is about knowing the difference between what is quitting and what is giving up. And I laughed in it. I cried in it. And it was just really helpful at this stage of the game, you know, getting to year 4 of Fraud Finder, where we're at the cusp of like, okay, you know, we have something here. We've got our initial traction. And just sticking with it, even when it feels like it's slow and painful. But I will say the one book that really shaped certainly the most recent 2 years for me was Finding Your True North. And I forget the author of it. I'm drawing a blank. It follows a bunch of different leaders. And it talks about how all of the best leaders have this you know, really painful, and not all of them, of course, most of them have this really painful experience in their life that really shifts how they approach work and how they approach life and the balance between it and the decisions that they make. And I, you know, recently went through a divorce and figuring out, you know, how to run a startup and be a single person with two businesses. And, you know, all of that was just very difficult. They call that like your crucible. And so having read that book made me shift my priorities and say, okay, what is really important? It's relationships, it's people, it's taking care of your own people, not chasing revenue and growth and that kind of thing. So that really made a difference the last 2 years.
Share something that you purchased in the last 12 months, it's less than $100, that you enjoyed or made your job easier. If it's good enough for Karen Weber, it's good enough for the world. What would that be?
Oh my gosh. Well, I finally broke down and I bought one of those ring lights, you know, that you put behind your computer when you're on a Zoom call.
Yes. The glorified makeup lights for,
where I sit, and I work from home largely, and the afternoon sun is like directly behind me. So I'm always in the dark. So finally, I'm like, I got to get one of those stupid lights. I don't want one, but so that's what I did. And it's been working out great.
If you had to do something else, if someone said, turn in your CPA license, turn in your CFE credential, you are no longer a forensic accountant, CPA, fraud examiner, you are done. Whatever reason it is, what would you be doing?
Some sort of creative expression that's more right-brained. You know, accounting is very left-brained. Entrepreneurship is not, right? That's a creative expression. But I love fashion and I love interior design. So I would probably gravitate over there. You know, something the complete opposite of accounting where I've lived the last 15 years.
But Karen, there's no debits and credits. There's no right and wrong. I mean, come on.
There is. No, that's going to be tough. I like big problems. I'm up for it.
All right, Karen. Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I really do appreciate it. And good luck to you on your firm and good luck to you on your software company, Fraud Finder.
Great. Thanks so much.